Hi there, and welcome to My Cape York Life, stories from the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula.
We got a really good view of the river from here and a lot of rainforest. Pretty beautiful place that we have here. I think we're quite lucky to live here.
Just understand that this country is pretty special.
And the wet season completely closes, you know, all those areas. The rivers flood just amazingly. That whole Princess Charlotte Bay area is incredible.
Just being outdoor and being connected to the country, it's always been home for me. And yeah, I'm glad to be working here.
Cape York is almost as big as the state of Victoria, but it's home to just 15,000 people. Tens of thousands more visit the Cape every dry season, drawn by adventure and the natural beauty of this spectacular area. Long-term residents, visitors past and future, My Cape York Life is for you. And it's for people who care about the health of this beautiful place and people who care for country. Spread the word, tell your friends. You can download earlier episodes of My Cape York Life from your podcast app or stream it from Cape York NRM Land Manager on Cape York NRM's website. Agriculture continues to have a significant presence on Cape York. Raising cattle or crops here is not easy. It's often too wet, then it's too dry, the soil can be average, and it's a very long way to get your produce to markets. Around the Cape, you'll meet people who rise to these and many other challenges, devising some really innovative ways to make agriculture work here and to look after Cape York country. We're at Lakeland in southern Cape York to meet Peter and Annette Marriott. Peter's worked all over the Cape in his 45 years here, and Annette has been here all of her life. Together, they run a cattle property called Ninda Creek. But that's not all they do. Like most people on the Cape, the Marriotts have more than one job. Over the years, they've done all kinds of work: building roads, digging dams, running remote cattle stations like Holroyd and Crocodile, and making an adventurous living on Cape York Peninsula.
We're on a 9,000 acre property just north of Lakeland. We've had good rain over the last 3 weeks, so it's beautiful and green outside. It looks like it's going to rain for the next few days as well. And after that, we'll be hoping for a couple of weeks of dry weather to get a bit of work done.
Annette, would you like to tell us a little bit about Ninda Creek?
We've got our cattle on here. We've basically got Brahman cattle and we've crossed them over with some Charolais and have virtually set it up that we can do it very easily for mustering, very easy maintenance.
So, Peter, you've been up on the Cape for some time. Can you tell us a little bit about where you came from, where you grew up, where you were born, and what brought you to Cape York and when?
I originally came from New South Wales. We had a property down there, 5,000 acres of very intensive farming, both cattle, sheep, wheat, oats. And we bought Crocodile in partnership with two Sydney doctors who were friends, and we had that for 22 years. I came up as a manager in 1970. I was 19, and it looked like the place to make some money, so I originally came up here because I was actually getting tired of ploughing small paddocks. That was my father's place, that was his life, and I needed to do something else.
So it must have been quite a bit different coming up to Cape York from where you grew up.
It certainly was, to come where to a place where to get the horses you had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go around the horse paddock two or three times to try and find them. To start work every day, it was completely different from New South Wales, where you just took the motorbike down. You could see them and took the motorbike down. In fact, I think we probably had one of the first motorbikes up here because I brought one up to get the horses in. Everyone looked at it a bit funny at first, but
yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, that was for sure, yeah.
So you've been a bit of I understand you've been a bit of an innovator over the years and brought some new ideas in as you've, in your time up here.
Yeah, well, that was a result of growing up on a mixed farm in New South Wales and not so remote, and we did a lot of intensive work, yeah. A year or so after I got here, the Quatermains bought Welcome Station, which was next door to Crocodile, and they had a son, Cameron, who was just a bit younger than me. Unfortunately, we bought Crocodile in 1970, and Quatermain's bought Welcome in 1972. And late 72, early 73, the cattle price crashed from nearly a dollar a kilo, about 95 cents a kilo, down to 15 cents a kilo, and it was like that for 6 years. So it became a very, very tough environment to survive, let alone make any money.
So that idea that you had of coming up to the Cape and you were going to make your fortune in cattle...
45 years later and nearly there.
So you were up at Crocodile and you were managing there. So what happened next? Where do you go from there?
After Crocodile, we in 1980, the cattle price had come back up again. We actually bought a property 1,200 square miles west of Cowan, Holroyd. When we bought it, it was 1,200 square miles, had no road to it, no yards, no buildings of any sort. It was about a third of it severe melon hole country, black soil melon hole country. It was very, very fertile type of country, but just about impossible to muster by horse.
Can you describe to us why that is and what melon hole country looks like?
Bad melon hole country, or the country at Holroyd, looked like bomb craters, just continual bomb craters everywhere. When they're full of water, you've just got a little island goes between, like a honeycomb, but it does hold the moisture and does is obviously more fertile than the rest of the country because the cattle prefer it to the sandwich country.
And this sandwich country sort of borders the melon hole country?
Yeah. The melon hole country is on the eastern side of Holroyd and the western side is all sandwich. The sandwich country is good wet weather country.
Yeah.
The sandwiches generally have better water. The black soil is bad for water. And we did actually put some dams in there, even when we were first putting the road through, to have a look around, knowing that the black soil was short of water.
So tell us a bit about that. So here you are, you're a young fella, full of beans on the Cape, making your way into the cattle industry up this way. You've obviously come from that kind of lifestyle growing up. You know, that's your background. And you've just bought Holroyd, and you've neighbouring with some of Cape York's pioneer cattle families. What happens the first time you go in to Holroyd?
Well, when we went, we were very surprised because in the first year we'd actually put dams on right beside the black soil, and we had intended the next year to take coaches up and start coacher mustering. But when I went to the first dam, there might have been 400 clean skin cattle there around the dam, and we didn't see how we could put 400 wild cattle into 60 coaches, so we had to rethink. And Peter Wallace, who was up there helping us at the time, said that he'd heard in the territory that a helicopter could put cattle in the yard if we had Hessian wings. So we decided that might be the way to go. So we found a helicopter. I ruled out the Hessian wings because I didn't like that idea we put up.
Didn't think that was such a good idea at the time?
No. But in retrospect, you can see that's the way to go.
So when are we talking? What year is this around?
This is 1980. Anyway, it worked out very successful. Again, no one had seen the helicopter working and we didn't trust it, so we had five ringers on horses to come down and help the helicopter if he got into trouble. But as soon as the horses turned up, that's when the trouble started, because the bulls could actually see something to charge. And for a while there was a complete confusion of dust and helicopter and horses and bulls all mixed up in the middle. At the end we got it down to a fairly fine art.
And what about pretty wild country out that way as well? When you first went out there, were there roads?
No, there was no roads at all. We had to build whatever roads. We first of all had to build a road to get there.
How did you get in the first time? Did you just horseback or
drove in? No, we drove in through the bush.
Yep.
And we're lucky not to get lost and then said, righto, well, this is where we'll start to put a road in. But the road from Yarradon, we initially were going in through Merripa and then up the range and onto the tableland. That was a long way round, so we did ask Yarradon, Barry Shepherd, if we'd be possible to put a road through there. He did indicate that he couldn't even get his four-wheel drive Land Rover through there, so he didn't like our chances of building a double-decker road through there, but we did eventually build build a road right through to Holroyd, and then we built it right through to Wathaneen.
The hard work, or, you know, had you been doing, at that stage you'd already been building roads, or you'd had that experience before?
Not really. We had earth-moving machinery, but and reading maps wasn't a problem because it was all done by map.
So you've just driven in, your dozer in, and you've got your map on your lap and you're pushing a road through.
That's exactly right. In fact, the first night that I headed out, my father was going to follow me and bring a bit of fuel, and he had to go to Cohen and get some fuel, and I had to try and find this. There was an old track supposed to go through there. And I ended up at dark. I found the road, but I had to lie down in the bull dust because I had no swag and nothing to eat. Everything. About 1 o'clock in the morning, I don't know how he did it, but what had happened was that I'd started to move along a bit on the dozer, and I started not doing such a good track, and he'd tried to follow me, and then it got too bad for the Toyota, so he had to go back through Cohen and come right around. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, I heard a car, and he turned up with a swag and a tea. So, yeah.
Finally got there. So you must have seen quite a bit of change in cattle, and I suppose and the cattle industry on the Cape over time. So that was around 1980. Yeah. When did the BTEC, and can you tell us about what happened there and what that was all about?
Was the TB, it was an eradication scheme to try and get rid of the TB.
So a lot of people may not have a clue about what happened and what impact that had on the cattle industry, and particularly for somewhere like Cape York.
Well, a lot of the markets, the overseas markets, wouldn't take cattle from countries that where the cattle had TB. And in the case up there, the worst areas for TB seemed to be in the black soil where it carried large numbers of cattle. But the water was very, very limited. They're the places right through Holroyd and Kendall and down at Arrakoon where you get big numbers of cattle drinking on small water holes seemed to be where the TB was. On the Holroyd, in all the Sandwich country, we found very little TB. But the idea was to at least test everything or get rid of it. Take them off the place and have them, they all went through the sale yards and were killed.
So from Holroyd, where to then?
Back to Crocodile, but at that stage we decided that we'd get rid of the leasehold country.
And why was that? What were the changes that were happening that made you make that decision?
Probably the main one was the Mabo decision. No one knew what was going to be the end result. We're all living in the dark about where this would end up. And so we thought it'd be better to invest in freehold country, which gave us a little bit more land security, even though 30 years later, there's not much difference now between what you can do on freehold and what you can do on leasehold. That gap's closed right up. But in conjunction with that, we did actually go contract mustering for about probably 5 or 6 years.
So describe to people who might be listening the life of a contract musterer. What where you go, what you do, what's a day's work like?
We did Dotswood. We invented a mobile trap, a seeing eye trap for cattle. And the idea was that you put it out there, put hay in it, and the cattle came in and they walked through a beam and the gate turned behind them, because what had happened when the cattle price was really bad, everyone was trying to cut labour out. The DPI were pushing traps that involved portable yards and only trapping one beast at a time, and then the trap is shut, which isn't very economical, especially if you've got to go 20 k's all the way out to it. So I designed this yard. We actually won the best invention over $4,000 at the National Field Day with it.
Oh, wow. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And we patented it with John Beattie. I got him to build them. We took them down to Dotswood, and we were still just in the stages of tidying, getting it right to this trap to see how the animals behaved. And we actually set the trap up, and we sat up in the windmill to see what the cattle, the bulls and everything would do when they came in. So we started off there, and then they said, well, while you're here, why don't you clean up all the cattle here too? So we did that, contract mustering, and then we went out to Strathmore then from there.
So where are these places? If you can give people a bit of an idea, like how far is Strathmore from... Where's the biggest population centre, maybe Cairns, how far away, and how do you get there?
Dotswood is just over the range from Townsville. Mm-hmm. It's an army training centre now. Yeah, it was owned by Coutts Brothers, and they wanted to clean that out. I think they were selling it to the army at that stage, so we spent a fair bit of time there cleaning that out. And then they also own Strathmore. I'm not sure. I don't think the TB was still going there. Yes, it was. So they wanted the paddocks clean, and they couldn't get the paddocks clean, so they asked us to go out there, and we went out there for about 6 months.
Yeah, and that's a fair way west.
Yeah, sorry, that is west of Georgetown, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yep. So that's probably 7-hour drive from somewhere like Cairns?
Yeah, that's what it'd be, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so it was very interesting out there. Even out there, that it had its problems because I couldn't believe it had been owned by Queensland Stations for years and years and years. And we were camped at Minnie's, which is an outstation, and to get across the Irnsley River was very, very heavy sand. And they were telling us, in the Queensland Stations days, they used to muster there. There was a paddock called Queera Paddock, and I can't remember the other paddocks, but they used to muster there. They start out with 1,000 head, and they go into the first 100 metres of rubber vine before the river. And then by the time they got through that rubber vine, through the river and through the rubber vine on the other side of the river, there'd only be 300 left. And we thought, well, we weren't going to make much money by doing that. So we actually got a little dozer. I think it only took him about 6 hours, and we pushed a road through, and we carted them all out by road. We pushed the dirt in from one side and the dirt from the other side beside a water hole so we could water the road.
Yeah, okay.
And we carted them all out.
And you were one of the first up here at the Cape. You were one of the first people to bring in the double-deckers.
No, I didn't actually bring it in, but I brought the idea up, and I did actually tell Geoffrey Burns that, no, there's no reason why you can't have a double-decker up here.
Yeah.
And I think he was the first one to buy a double-decker here.
Yeah.
He was carting our cattle at that time.
Okay. Was that up here to Lakeland, or was that up at Holroyd?
No, that was very early. That was actually prior to the cattle depression when Jeff bought that first truck and started... Mm. Carting double-decker cattle out of here.
Out of Crocodile.
Yeah.
If you can tell us how far Holroyd is, like even how far, you know, to the turnoff, and then how far it is in to get into the station itself off the PDR.
Holroyd would be... It used to take us 30 hours to come out in the truck, I know that.
Yeah.
Down to Cairns with a load of cattle.
Yeah, that's...
30 hours.
30 hours from... From
Holroyd to Cairns with a truckload of cattle. But then when we put the road through Yarradon, we cut that down to about 24 hours straight through.
Peter Marriott at Ninda Creek near Lakeland, Cape York Peninsula. And Peter mentions the long drive out of Holroyd Station in a double-decker cattle truck, 30 hours to Cairns, which is around 700 kilometres away. I reckon that's about 20 kilometres per hour.
My Cape York Life, brought to you by Cape York Natural Resource Management. Find us with a search Cape York Land Manager or look for My Cape York Life in your favourite podcast app.
We're with Peter and Annette Marriott on their cattle property near Lakeland at the southern end of Cape York Peninsula. Annette and Peter got together in the early 90s. Annette has been on the Cape all of her life. She grew up on a property near Cooktown at a time when the place was quite a bit more isolated.
We actually lived on a little property outside of Cooktown, so I really only went to school in town and then moved straight back out to the, caught the school bus back out to the property, and that was my sole life, living on the little farm out there. My father grew seed and my mother worked in at the hospital, so we lived that far out of town that Mum didn't even come home between shifts. She only came home for her days off. We probably had a very isolated childhood in that our toilet was still a thunderbox out the back right until I was 18 and when Mum and Dad sold the place. Our shower was, we had no running water. We had a tin for a shower, you know, where you pull the chain for the shower, and that, again, that was still in existence when my parents sold the farm. I came to Lakeland in beginning of 1989, and by then Peter was living in Lakeland, and that was where we sort of met, and 4 years later, we, in 1993, we got together.
When did you move here together?
We've had, Peter had this part of this property, 600 hectares of this property, with his first wife, and we, in 1999, we bought another 2,500 hectares off Bill and Laura.
What cattle do you run here?
We've basically got Brahman cattle, but we've crossed Charolais bulls over them, and we're now in the process of putting some centre poles over them so that we can end up with a totally polled herd rather than having to dehorn.
When I first came up here, I thought it's leached country, it needs phosphate. That was probably responsible for about 75% of the
lack of growth in the cattle, or slow growth. Slow response.
Yeah, and that breeding was only a small part of that, that the genes were only a small part of that problem. But since then, since we've been using the Charolais bulls, we've come to realise that maybe our genetics aren't quite as good as we thought they were, and that the, that half of the non-production is from not having the right genetics.
And that's something that you've worked on, and now you think you're getting that right?
I suppose it goes, we have to really go back. One of the things that we've found is when you live in the Cape, you've got all your grass at this time of the year during the wet season. You know, we've got that much grass that you'd feed thousands of head of cattle at this time of the year. But as you go into the dry season, you've actually got nothing left. There's no protein left in the grass whatsoever. Where Peter and I have made some major changes is trying to have a little bit of improved pasture. We bale, we brought our own balers and mowers and everything so that we can bale anything up to 4,000 bales of hay a year. And out of that, we try and sell 1,000 bales, and that covers our costs of baling. And then the remaining 3,000 we feed back to our cattle through the year. That way we're managing to keep them in a condition that they will calve every year, if not every year, you know, every sort of 14 months instead of every 2 years. That was the first major change that we really did. And then we thought, we were still looking at them and saying, well, we're not getting the production that we should be getting, so let's go and have a look at the genetics. And trying to have polled cattle was something we felt very important, because neither of us like cutting their heads off, half their heads off. We sort of felt that it's also for good RSPCA reasons, you know.
Yep, so people might not understand what polled cattle are.
Having cattle with no horns, so that we can, we're actually breeding now cattle with no horns rather than them having the big horns. And markets don't like cattle with horns, because trucking them,
We won't take them unless you cut their horns off.
Yeah, that's something that you're told. That's part of the industry, yeah.
That is actually a market demand that they don't have horns. And even to send cattle on the boat cattle, they have to have horns that are less than 100 mil long and no sharp points and things like that. So we've said, righto, we would like our cattle that have no horns eventually, have a pure no-horned herd. So we decided to go and buy some Charolais bulls. We also wanted a softer breed for meat reasons. And so looked at the round and said, well, we can get access Charolais very easy off the tablelands. And we're buying them where they genetically, even if they breed with a cow that has horns, the calf will come out with no horns. Mm. So they're what they call genetically double-polled. So that was where we started. Then we, as time went on, we were having a bit of problems with ticks. The Charolais don't have the tick resistance that Brahmins have, and the buffalo fly. So we've got a fair bit of the Charolais in now, and we're saying, well, we need to do something a little bit different. And just this last few months ago, we purchased three centipole bulls. And the centipole have the tick resistance and fly resistance of the Brahmins, but they are pure polled bulls as well.
So quite a bit of innovation and looking at new ways of doing things for the Cape.
We're trying hard to sort of, I suppose, meet market demands and have some cattle with a bit of growth in them, and also trying to keep them in a little bit of condition so that they can reproduce every year.
As far as we're concerned, the two big issues for us all over the north, we grow heaps and heaps of protein. We grow this grass every year and then we let it all just dry off and deteriorate until there's no protein. Then we go down the road and buy the protein and cart it back up. We need to get away from that. We need to be able to conserve that protein. There's no need to buy it. We've already grown it.
Yeah.
So that's one issue. And the second issue is that we've got to have cattle that perform. As I said before, we used to think it was the peninsula was that tough. That was the reason why the cattle didn't perform well. But we've since realised that it's only part of the story. The other part of the story is having the genes that can make use of the available feed, and we're trying to address both of them.
One of the things that I often hear when we're talking about the cattle industry on the Cape, there's not many of those glorious homesteads. You know, we're not making millions out of our industry on the Cape, and there's not many families around, I would think, who are in cattle up here that can. Well, they might be able to live solely on cattle, but there's generally another off-farm income as well. Is that the case for you too?
Yes, we worked out long ago that if we wanted to do any improvements at all on the property, we had to get some sort of off-farm income. So Peter and I have basically been in earth moving since 1993, and we've done a lot of work in a lot of different places, building dams, roadworks, fencing.
I don't think there's many people on the Cape who don't know you.
Probably not. Yeah. Although probably is nowadays. There's a lot of new people.
But when it comes to farming, you know, you're out there doing a lot of work. You're building dams, you're building roads, you're fencing, doing lots of different things now, aren't you?
We have done in the past, We have, I suppose, the last couple of... Well, since our youngest son was born, which is 17 years ago, we don't move around like we used to. You know, the first probably 6 years that we were together, we spent three quarters of that time living in a 17-foot caravan, going from Springvale up to Coolinga, out to Innotts Hot Springs, round Dimbula, out to St. Ronan's west of Mount Garnet. We did a lot of travelling around looking for work, and then we were fortunate after Glenn was born that was right when they started doing the Mulligan Highway from the Byers Town to Cooktown. So we were able to stay home, work our machinery on the various road sections of road, And then since that stopped, that was when we took up the fencing, because there was very little machinery work going at that stage, and we were probably at that, we were also had the property, this cattle property that we're on now, where we couldn't go away. Our cattle numbers were sufficiently high that we couldn't move away. We had to be here to manage that. Mm. And so that was when we took up the fencing. And teak trees, sandalwood, that provided a very good income for fencing. Again, the Mulligan Highway.
I think we did 55 kilometres of netting fence at the teak trees just here right beside us.
Is that right?
55 k's.
Wow.
And virtually fenced both sides of the Mulligan Highway to the Little Annan.
Is that right? And you're both doing that work, aren't you?
Yeah, it's pretty well, we've had one employee for most of that time, but yeah, it's pretty well Pedro and myself, yes.
And it's hard work, it's not, is it?
Dad's army, and Peter's very innovative. He's come up with some very, very good equipment, like boat winches for fence strainers, wire strainers, and V-bins with premix and water on them for cement, a trailer to run the netting out with a brake on it so that you can, which he does, and Pedro and I had to come along and clip it all off. But, some very innovative equipment, which has made our life very easy and made us very efficient for fencing. Mm. Oh, post bangers.
Yeah.
Jackhammer post bangers on a winch.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the back of the vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So having been here on the Cape for a long, well, all of your life, Annette, and for a long time, 45 years, 45 odd years, is that right? Mm-hmm. You must have seen a few changes and seen a few things. Have you got any stories, or what are some of the big things that stand out in the time you've been here?
To me, the biggest one is that the road up the peninsula, because in 1972, when Gough Whitlam got in, he changed the peninsula road from being a beef road to a nondescript road. And I think at one stage we went about 2 years where there was no grader, went over the range, and we used to travel on stone from here to Carbine. Mm. You were just travelling on rock the whole way. Mm. And then successive Labor governments after that, Liberal governments, did 2Ks this year and 2Ks next year, and I thought, I'm never going to live long enough to see bitumen to Lakeland, ever. Mm. It's just not going to happen. And then we had about three big sections done in a period of a couple of years, mm, and finally got the bitumen to Lakeland, but I didn't think I'd ever see it in my lifetime.
And what kind of a difference has that made?
Oh, unbelievable, because I think everyone knows the upkeep on vehicles and the damage to stock, cutting them down, the bitumen is just beautiful.
Mm. So not, and not just for your own personal comfort, it's for industry.
Yeah. I agree with Peter totally. The roads was just the incredible change. I mean, as a child in Cooktown, if we went to Cairns, it was probably once a year, and you'd leave at daylight and didn't get to Cairns until that night. Mm. And now...
And now it's about 350 kilometres or 400 kilometres.
Yeah, and now, like, it takes you 50 minutes to go from Cooktown to Lakeland, and I can do from Lakeland to Cairns in 3 hours. So in 4 hours now, what used to take 12 hours, mm, is a huge difference.
Mm. And a lot more comfortable, because you're not going over those rock.
Rock all the way, yeah. Mm.
I mean, also for children, I mean, when I was a child, there was no high school in Cooktown, so everyone had to go to boarding school, and your parents just couldn't even get you home on a free weekend, let alone it was hard to get you home on school holidays. For now, for us, we've had our son at boarding school, and every free weekend we can go down and pick him up and bring him home for the weekend and take him back down.
It's a massive change.
Massive, yeah. And just to go shopping. You know, if you need a part, hey, there's transports around. Every day we've got a transport now. Freight is so easy.
They're some of the things that people take for granted when you live close to a city, or, you know, that you can just pop down to the hardware shop or to the mechanics and get something, pick up the part that you need. But even here in Lakeland, where we're 3.5 hours from Cairns, it still takes 3.5 hours to get a part here, let alone shipped up from wherever it needs to come from.
One thing that I can remember going back to when I first came up here, obviously when the road was bad, everyone used to buy cartons of everything. And when I first went to Crocodile, all the tin fruit and the tin jams had no labels on them. Billy Wallace used to pull all the labels off because everyone would eat all the good jam first. And the good fruit first. So the best way to fix that was to take all the labels off, and then so you took put luck on what you got.
Oh, that's pretty funny. So you can leave the labels on these days.
Yeah, these days you only buy 2 tins of fruit, not buy a carton of it.
Yeah.
That is one of the big things. You know, the wet season back then was something that you really had to plan for, you know, especially for food-wise, because even growing up in Cooktown, access was just impossible during the wet season. And so the shops used to buy in bulk, and everybody bought cartons of this and cartons of that, and made sure they had plenty of food for the wet season. You couldn't just go to the corner store. And probably the other big benefit that we've had in the last few years is electricity. Lakeland had its own power source, generators and everything, relying on diesel. And I think Peter will tell you, when Foyster first went bankrupt, there were times when he had to bring diesel in from Crocodile just so that there was electricity here at Lakeland. As a child in Cooktown, we often had no power for days on end. And with having the ring electricity coming up the coast and going down the inland road, it's very rare we lose our power now, which is really nice.
Which sort of leads us to the future. What do you think the future is for the beef cattle industry for the Cape, and also just for land management in general? What do you see? What are your hopes and aspirations, but also what do you see as the big challenges that we might have on the Cape?
The future of the Cape will depend a lot on how the government looks at expanding agricultural industries in the Cape. At Lakeland here, the one thing we really, really do need is more water. And until such times as we're able to access more water and have an easy pathway to accessing that water, Lakeland will stagnate. It's reached its full potential until such times as we do get more water. And as far as the beef industry is concerned, people need to be able to have some cleared land for improved pastures, to be able to make their own hay, whether they get a contractor in to bale it or what, because it goes back to the same thing. We've got all this protein here in the wet season, and by the end of the year there's nothing left. And they need to be able to harness that protein while they've got it. And the one way they can is by baling some hay. But to bale hay, they need to have a cleared, clean paddock.
And that's the case for producers all over the country where they can do that.
It's probably not as the northern part of Australia, where you get the heavy dews, where you get the showers in the wintertime, which we get, and the heavy dews, every time the grass, once it's dry, gets wet, it loses part of its protein. And so it doesn't apply cattle at Yuendon and all across the territory and the good parts of the territory, a mud, fat, beautiful cattle on dry feed. Because that dry feed hasn't been destroyed by the
moisture.
Continual heavy dews that wet it every night and every morning. If you get 20 points of rain at Yuendon on dry feed, it destroys it. But we get the equivalent every night if we get this heavy dew. So we've actually got to be able to conserve that. Yuendon, you conserve it, leave it in the paddock. You know, you just that paddock's okay as long as it doesn't get 20 points of rain. But right across the north of Australia, where you've got the high lots of dews and lots of showers, we've actually got to put it in a bale. Otherwise, if we just leave it there, there's nothing. One of the things that, after talking to one of my friends who have been here the same time, he said that at least we're going to be able to have a very flash funeral. For the price of cattle like they are.
So from that time when you first moved up and you thought, yeah, we're going to make some money here, and it went downhill real quick, and prices are back up again?
Yeah, prices are good at the moment. They do need to stay there because every day there's more government interference, which is any government interference, of course, is associated with cost. We can't take any less than we are now, otherwise all of the things that were, all the improvements that you're actually doing, like feeding molasses and urea and those sorts of things to try and get the best production out of your cattle, you've got to start weaning them off one at a time as the cattle price goes. Apart from that, I mean, all we've got to do is hope for good cattle prices and less government interference.
Well, Peter and Annette Marriott, thank you very much for welcoming us here this afternoon to Ninda Creek. It's been lovely having you both and talking to you both.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks, Linda.
Peter and Annette Marriott at Ninda Creek near Lakeland. My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York NRM with support from South Cape York Catchments and the Australian Government's National Land Care Program. You can stream or download us from Cape York Land Manager, or search My Cape York Life on your favourite podcast app. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Next time on My Cape York Life...
We're here in Woodjawoodjaw, which is 3 hours north of Cairns, 1 hour south of Cooktown, and the lower part of Cape York, where the rainforest meets the sea. We've got a really good view of the river from here and close to the floodplain of this Bloomfield River, and the water comes right up near the back veranda, and in the wet season we do get a lot of rain here. We're in an area where it's pretty mountainous, a lot of rainforest hills, pretty beautiful place that we have here. I think we're quite lucky to live here.
We're going where the rainforest meets the coral sea, Woodjawoodjaw. We'll hear about the joys and challenges of life in a small Cape York Indigenous community. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.